Hi there and welcome to Everyday Business with me, Aidan Donnelly. I've been analysing and investing in companies for nearly 30 years and I'm fascinated by how companies operate, the entrepreneurs who start them and the business people and managements that run them. In this podcast, I'll be talking to a whole host of people with different stories, backgrounds and journeys, learning about their businesses and gleaning some insights and lessons from their experience. For those that are listening, don't forget to like, share and subscribe if you enjoy what you hear. So without further ado to today's episode. Sarah Savage has a deep understanding of domestic, regional and global payment systems, solutions, infrastructure, strategic partnerships and regulatory framework with her over 25 years experience of driving sustainable growth and building high performance teams across a range of institutions in the payments industry, including Fiserv, TransferMate, RBS and Barclays. Sarah is now the CEO of the Fexco Corporate and International Payments business, which provides cloud-based cross-border solutions for clients, and took up this role following many years in JPMorgan Chase, where she served as Managing Director of Payments for International Growth and Business Development, playing a critical role integrating new strategic growth agendas within the EMEA, LATAM and APAC payment divisions. She is also a proud part of the Women in Payments, Women in Sales, European Women's Payment Network and other key industry forums as a mentor, advisor and event supporter, focused on driving change to elevate all underrepresented groups across many different payments, banking, finance, STEM and fintech communities. Sarah, you are very welcome to the podcast.
Many thanks, Aidan. It's great to be here on a sunny afternoon here in Dublin.
Certainly is. Now, where to begin? I think a good place would be, many people in this country probably recognise the Fexco name from the bureaus and the airports and things like that. But that really doesn't explain the business, or more importantly, the scale and scope of Fexco.
Yeah.
So can you tell me about it?
Well, Aidan, foreign exchange is definitely how Fexco started in Killorglin, County Kerry, back in 1981. However, since then, we've grown into a bit of a global success story with nearly 3,000 people dotted across the world, with clients and operations in over 50 countries. Fexco has been delivering great outcomes for partners and our clients for more than 40 years. And the group has three core divisions. As a leading global fintech, the Fexco Payments Division processes more than 37 billion in euro transaction value each and every year, empowering acquirers, payment service providers and organisations of all sizes to send, receive, exchange or make a payment. With a range of solutions including currency conversion, international payments, retail FX and payments orchestration, Fexco has played a key role in the global payments ecosystem for a number of years. Mm. Our Business Services Division provides property, managed and advisory services, along with supporting specialist sectors such as the insurance and aviation industries with market-leading solutions too. And at Fexco, we've always been deeply committed to delivering for the next generation of trailblazers. And our Innovation and New Ventures division continues to co-create, invest and provide an environment where new ideas and technologies can really thrive, which is why we're so proud of the award-winning RDI Hub located in Killorglin. It's a centre of excellence where we bring together corporates, SMEs, startups and industry experts to innovate for the future.
Okay.
Fexco has always been pretty broad and a very diverse organisation in terms of the solutions that we provide, the industries that we serve and the markets in which we operate. However, one thing each and every business division has in common is the commitment to delivering great outcomes and innovation, which both remain right at the very centre of absolutely everything that we do.
The payments industry has changed so much over the last 25 years. When you look back in it, you know, obviously huge changes, but the basic fundamentals remain the same. You've got your client expectations to get the payment from one place to the other place seamlessly. They don't care how it's done.
Yep.
They just care that it's done.
Yeah. And I guess, look, you've hit the nail on the head there. The fundamentals of payments really haven't changed, but the way that we do it, consumer expectation has shifted significantly. Legislation, regulation has shifted and changed. If I think about maybe, you know, sort of 25, 30 years ago when I first moved into payments in Barclays, it was just literally a point of sale terminal, a card payment. And how we moved that money was pretty much the same as every other acquirer or payment organisation out there. Whereas now, consumers drive choice. Historically, it always used to be businesses would offer certain solutions and consumers had to adopt those. Whereas now, I suppose one of the fundamental shifts is consumers are really driving what payments companies come up with and how they innovate as well.
So I suppose the natural thing question then is, does it matter if we were all to switch over to a digital Bitcoin currency, or is it just another currency that needs to be paid?
Oh my goodness, the evolution of the digital currency. I remember not so long ago, I think I would say probably around 2012, 2013, being challenged on a panel session out in San Francisco by an online travel agency. Giving me a little bit of a hard time on the panel because we hadn't implemented Bitcoin whilst I was working for First Data at Fiserv. And as I say, it gave me a really hard time. And the reason being is that because it wasn't regulated as a payment service provider, you need to make sure that you can comply not only with consumer demand and the needs of our businesses, but we also need to make sure from a regulatory perspective that we're absolutely on point to make sure that client funds are protected and the flows are fully compliant. You know, here we are, sort of, 15, 20 years later now, and Bitcoin really still didn't take off. But the evolution of cryptocurrencies, the evolution of stable coins in particular, is something that we're really excited to see take off. The challenge that you've got is, how do you regulate it? How do you control it? And how do you keep consumer funds safe?
And that's the key at the end of it, because that's what people expect.
It is. It's fundamental. I suppose, look, when the evolution from cash to card payments really started to take off, people could feel and touch cash. They knew where it was. Now you've got the evolution of card payments, alternative local methods of payments as well, wallets. If you think back pre-COVID, you would never have really leaned so heavily on your wallets, on your digital wallets that you have now. I remember, my parents would never shop online, and yet now my dad gets an Amazon delivery literally every single week. Right. And it's part of the DNA now, whereas that evolution took a little bit of time, accelerated, obviously, because of COVID. But what's next for payments? And those the coins, the digital currencies, stable coins, CBDCs, they're all key and fundamental. But I guess as an institution, as an organization and as a provider, we've got to work out how we apply what is needed from our consumers in with the regulatory demands that are placed upon us as well.
And in terms of innovation within the industry, is it, is it you guys leading it in terms of the payment providers, or is it you guys all the time trying to keep up where the consumer demand is within the realm of the regulation?
So spotting key industry trends is something that we absolutely stay on point with. And I guess, look, if I think back to FEXCO's history and strength, innovation really was core and remains core and a key part of our business and one of our key values as well, that curiosity, making sure that not only are we staying ahead of the trends, but we're predicting and trying to identify and work out not only what the consumers need, but what the payment processors need as well. Because our line of business, our payments organization, we serve third-party acquirers and payment processors as well. So we need to make sure that we're giving them the tools that they need as well. So spotting, recognizing, and then taking action to deliver against consumer trends. Some things we will absolutely adopt, some things we will lead on, other things we will perhaps maybe take our time. And that again goes back to the digital currencies and coins, just to make sure that we're doing the right thing at the right time, making sure that we are fully compliant.
Your career has gone from massive companies to not as large, but still a large company. Do you have a preference, massive over large?
My goodness, do I have a preference? My goodness. So I suppose, look, if I think back to my own career, it's always been in payments, always for large blue chip organizations. You highlighted Barclays, RBS, JP Morgan, Fiserv. They're huge organizations. And I guess when you've worked for the two largest, the world's largest processors of payments, what do you do next? And I suppose for me, on a personal level, to learn and to grow is something that maybe in the last couple of roles, I didn't find that I grew quite as much, because it was the same kind of responsibilities always around that international growth development. I'm a sales girl by trade, right? So trying to make sure that I'm continuing to learn and grow. So the move to FEXCO, which happened in November of 2023, was a really conscious decision of mine to move into an organization. I'd worked with FEXCO for the last 15, 20 years or so. So I knew them really, really well. They were a partner. They were a key supplier and great friends of us, both in JP Morgan and in Fiserv as well. So when the opportunity came along to move to Fexco, I considered how and where I would be able to grow. And I think having responsibility for the full end-to-end part of an organization like the International Payments Division, of which I run, having that full responsibility end-to-end, everything from customer to infrastructure to regulatory demands and everything in between, making sure that you kind of embrace that, you learn from it, you also challenge the organization to diversify and you know, take it on its transformation journey as well. So I wouldn't say it's a preference. I would say what it is, it's very much a diversification in my own career portfolio and my own kind of career trajectory as well.
I've had previous guests on who have made that same switch, and one of the big drivers behind it was the desire to have make a real difference, where when you're in massive organizations, your scope for to create and to move in an agile way just isn't there. That, you know, sometimes you want to be a bigger fish in a small pond to actually make change.
Yeah, it's a really good point. So if I think back to my career, like in your 20s, Aidan, right, what I found I was doing in my 20s, I was trying to work out what I want to do, right? What do I want to do? What do I want to be? And when you get to your 30s and potentially 40s, you're chasing the promotion, you're chasing the profile, the platform, the paycheck, all of that good stuff, and trying to elevate your career. I guess a number of years ago when I hit 50, for me, it was more about impact. Mm. Where could I work where I could have the deepest and most significant amount of impact? In an organization like Fexco, I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that we have a meeting on a Tuesday, make a decision on a Wednesday, and by Friday we're executing. Mm. I'm not suggesting it's that, but it's certainly easier within a smaller, more dynamic organization. We have an amazing leadership group and community within the Fexco leadership team that really wants to, one, innovate, but also deliver really great outcomes for our consumers, for our customers, and for our partners as well. And I think that really has been a big difference for me.
Given its history, and I think more to do with its location, right? Fexco, I'm sure, has a very unique culture. Mm. Tell me about it and what attracted you to it.
Yeah, so Fexco, we've got nearly 3,000 people across the globe. We've got operations, clients and colleagues based in nearly 50 countries. So we're a very global, very diverse organisation. What appealed to me was, I suppose, the vision of the leadership. When I think back to how we started back in 1981, right? Brian McCarthy came up with a super idea that was all based around FX, FX provision of FX services and cross-border and cross-currency conversion. And that idea really transformed into, I suppose, being one of the original fintechs. Mm. Can we be a fintech and 40 years old? Mm. I don't know. It all seems to be, you know, a very, very hip, very, very new word. Mm. But actually, Fexco is one of the original fintechs. And I suppose when I look at the organization, it is the only fintech in existence at this moment in time that has orchestration. It has the FX component and it has the payout capability. Mm. There's no other fintechs or badge themselves as a fintech that can do that today. So it puts us in a pretty unique position. So what drew me, I guess, to Fexco is the opportunity to really be part of that transformation journey. The executive within Fexco have a really ambitious set of objectives that they want to really accelerate the growth of the organization. We've gone through the last number of years of innovating. We have a history and a reputation for innovation. I think that's one of the main appeals, but also just the opportunity. We have an amazing team within the organization, no matter where they're dotted across the globe. And when I look at the can-do, will-do approach and attitude, when I look at the way that customers really are put right at the very centre of everything that we do, but also the people aspect. Everybody's valued, everybody's respected, everybody is curious, and everybody really feels as if they're on that journey for, you know, to accelerate the growth of the next phase of Fexco.
You mentioned the customer-centric aspect to it, and the thing about customers are they're great at telling you what's wrong, but not necessarily telling you what the solution is to that problem, right? So how do you interact and get that, you know, those kind of barriers brought down in, you know, when you're dealing with the customers?
Yeah, I suppose one of the elements of our success has been the fact that we really take time to get to know what drives our customers, right? So that value driver approach to relationships, really. people, I guess, as a sales girl, as mentioned, you know, people don't buy from people. Organisations buy from companies if they're clear in terms of what they can deliver for them. And I think what FEXCO has done over the last number of years is really demonstrated how we can drive those great outcomes for our customers and our partners. We take time to really understand what makes them tick, what their objectives, what their growth drivers are, and then align our solutions. And it's not unusual for us to build bespoke. We've got a number of propositions in place and solutions in place where we've bespoke built those for our clients to help really accelerate their growth. If you take, for example, our orchestration business at this moment in time, we're supporting just over a third of the cruise industry, right? Which for a company that's quite small, like FEXCO with less than 3,000 people, how is that possible? And the reason it's possible is because you really invested time trying to understand what problems and pain points are they experiencing and how can we solve for them? And because we are agnostic in an awful lot of what we do in terms of that orchestration piece, it allows us to sit on the fence but guide and direct customers and really take that impartial view. If I think about my own line of business, the international payments line of business, again, we've got a number of key partnerships and strategic clients. For example, we support a number of government entities. We support a number of payment processors and aggregators as well. And finding out where their challenges are, what part, what role do they want to play in that play in that payments process, and identify where they do want to play, what we can do to support them, but where they don't want to play, what can we do to fill in those gaps for them. Okay. Being obviously a regulated entity by the Central Bank of Ireland, it means that we can support them in ways that perhaps maybe they don't want to, or they don't have or don't wish to have those obligations.
Yeah, exactly.
So if I think about us, what really separates and differentiates us as an organization is the practicalities of really lifting the bonnet to try and understand. And I mean, look, I think about, you know, what our customers say about us with an NPS of 76, which is unheard of in the industry, and a Trustpilot rating of 4.9. Again, our customers are quite open to tell us how great we're doing. But on the flip side of that, because the relationships that we have, they're very quick as well to tell us what they expect of us as well. And that open dialogue and relationship really does help drive really good outcomes for everybody.
Yeah. And when you look at the business, it's always a risk. When the bigger businesses get, sometimes the level of innovation falls. It's just a natural, it just drifts away. And, you know, businesses get comfortable in the areas that they're doing. So, you know, given we haven't seen it over the 40 years in FEXCO. So why do you think they are able to beat that trend of just kind of, you know, the innovation just falling a little bit each year and suddenly, you know, you're behind the curve?
Yeah, I suppose for us, you know, historically we focus very much around the core part of our business, which is the payments organisation. Demands have changed. I think for us, if we look at a lot of the relationships we have with the tier one acquirers across the globe at this moment in time, we have around 70 key relationships with payment processors at the moment. We've had those relationships in place, some of them for over 20 years. And you know, we have a really good partnership with them, driving their objectives and obviously them supporting our business as well. What's happened is, I suppose, a number of those acquirers are finding that they're getting competition from new companies coming in. And a lot of the services and solutions that they're building would perhaps maybe mean that our partners really need to up their game. And they are absolutely up in their game and they're diversifying. And I think the payments landscape historically over the last number of years has evolved so much that it gives the opportunity with PSD2 coming in. It gave the opportunity for new entrants to come in without the same regulations. A lot of the acquirers that we support today, they have been in place for a number of years. So they are the financial services organizations that have evolved into tech organizations, whereas a lot of the new entrants, they're tech organizations that just happen to have.
To stick their nose into the financial services.
Exactly,
side of it.
Yeah. Exactly. So we've got some amazing partners on the fintech side that are, you know, that we're pushing on ahead with. But we've also got these long-standing, very solid and very enviable relationships that we have with some of the tier one acquirers. You would have seen perhaps maybe in the news in recent times, you know, our partner strategic partnerships with the likes of JP Morgan, with Fiserv, with Nuvei, with AIB Merchant Services. All of these organizations are key and fundamental, obviously the other 70 as well. But it's that evolution. So we're continuing to innovate. We absolutely are. We've got new solutions coming through for our clients and for our partners each and every single year. But because the landscape is so diverse right now, it's difficult for fintechs of any size, Fexco or outside of Fexco, to really penetrate every single market. Mm. So rather than trying to be all things to all people, we really focus around doing a really good job in those niche areas where we know we're really, really strong.
And that can be a big danger too, that when people think they can be all things to all men, they end up disappointing so many clients.
Yeah, they do. They do. And I've seen that over the last number of years, right? Whereas within Fexco, we know what we do exceptionally well. We know the areas that we're really, really strong. The relationships we've got, we've been able to, you know, I suppose, adapt and accelerate the growth of those partnerships and relationships on both sides with you know, within our own organization and within the partners as well. But making sure that we remain compliant, make sure that, you know, consumers are treated fairly, make sure that legislation and the obligations we have around the regulatory side are upheld as well. And I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that others don't, but we know we sleep soundly at night and our customers sleep soundly at night knowing that we're fully compliant.
And I suppose, you know, the whole move in and obviously the next big thing, the whole thing around DORA and all of that, just is going to make the nature of relationships within financial services even more crucial, that you can A, trust the person you're dealing with, and B, sleep at night because they're going to do and uphold their end of the bargain for you.
Absolutely. On the 17th of January, right? So later this week, you know, these changes around DORA will have a fundamental impact on a number of different providers. You know, what we've seen over the last number of months in preparation for DORA is we've seen that some of the organisations that we know of in the industry, they're not prepared, they're not ready. And, you know, there's challenges here. I think different organisations, as mentioned, those that were a financial institution before that evolved to becoming a technology organisation, they've adapted pretty well. But those that perhaps maybe started as a technology company and maybe outsourced some of the regulatory obligations that they have, they're struggling, you know, a little bit. That's what we've, you know, that's what we've found. Certainly for us, you know, 17th of January is a great deadline for us. And I think for us to be able to demonstrate to our clients and to our partners that we are fully compliant, you know, is a strong statement.
Yeah. You're relatively new in the role, but how do you feel about what you've already done in the company? And, you know, what will success look like in the future for you?
Yeah, so my line of business has been in operation for the last 25 years. It's done a super, super job of serving a particular demographic of client, and we've looked after them exceptionally well over the last number of years. And, you know, I'm blessed to have such a strong management team and fantastic team, most of which are based in Kerry. I've got some outside of Kerry as well in different locations, but the fundamental core team are based down in Kerry. I think for me, it was to come in, lift the bonnet, try and understand what we've got, understand the proposition, understand the team, what we need to do to be able to accelerate growth across our business was really important for me. I suppose because I have a growth mindset and a business development background, for me, it's around how can we solve challenges and problems for our clients and partners that today we don't. So looking to open up new focus segments, looking to, you know, play in different areas and different arenas as well where we haven't tapped into previously is really important. The second part is as well is, you know, looking across the organisation, we've got some amazing talent. And I think, again, I go back to the point, you know, Kerry perhaps maybe isn't quite as populated, or definitely isn't as populated as Dublin or perhaps maybe Cork or other key cities here in Ireland. But we've got some amazing talent locally, and being able to grow that talent, being able to support that talent in terms of their growth agenda, and also being able to, you know, really look and identify what the business needs to be able to grow. And I think that was something for me to be able to come in, like I say, lift the bonnet, lift the boot, really understand what have we got there and how best can we move this organisation forward. So over the last sort of 12, 13 months that I've been here, we've gone on quite an exciting journey of transformation. More to come. 2025, you know, will be another strong year for us. We achieved the financial metrics that we needed to in 2024, which was fantastic. And we're really focused and excited about the year ahead.
And when you look at the business, is your preference to hire talent or develop from within?
It's a super question. So I would always be very keen on internal mobility, right? To be able to take people that perhaps maybe have a certain set of skills, but an aspiration to learn and grow is really important that we support and encourage that. I'm a great believer you can teach skills, you can impart knowledge, but you can't change your personality or you struggle to change your personality. So really spending time with folks within the organisation is something that we do across FEXCO and a broader group level as well. Really identify what are the aspirations, what do they want to do, and then give them the opportunity to be able to learn and grow. Put in place the, you know, the mentorship arrangements, both internal and external. We have a great internal mobility strategy and plan to support our people within the organisation, but also trying to make sure that we can use and leverage external networks to be able to help and support our people grow as well. You know, and that's succession planning. For me, you know, when I first came in, one of the first key things we needed to do was identify who are the key people within the team in terms of that leadership group, including myself, and put in firm succession plans to make sure that people have got goals to move towards, but also a clear and very concise development plan so that we can make sure that we're tracking against that, not just a, oh yeah, we'd like to move you into this role in the next 18 months, but putting a proper solid plan around it, because that's what I would have wanted.
Yeah, you see it particularly in sales cultures, but there's always that big question about, you know, you have somebody and they are the best at what they do, and you let them do it, but there's they leave collateral damage every which way. You know, as you try to manage them, you're kind of going, you know, they might be the greatest salesman, but the damage that they create is always that balance, and you just kind of go, from a cultural perspective of things like that, just can't have that. So how do you deal with that? You know, I often use, you know, you never want to be dealing with a talented asshole, right?
Yeah, fortunately we don't have that. Certainly haven't witnessed that within FEXCO, but in other organisations, absolutely, you can have the best salespeople, right? But like you say, they can in turn leave a trail of destruction behind. I suppose working in regulated entities and organisations, as I have done pretty much my whole working life, you can't tolerate that. You know, as I say, I would sacrifice anybody if they're not doing their role properly and they are leaving that trail of destruction. Then they would be be coached, they would be supported to grow, to make sure that there isn't that carnage behind, as you describe. But I think selling with integrity, ethical selling with morals is really important. I think back to maybe a period a long time ago, when perhaps maybe, you know, there were certain segments and certain verticals, high growth verticals like payday lending, or perhaps maybe, you know, adult content, or perhaps maybe gambling, which all would have been considered high risk, not from a financial perspective, but from a reputational risk. You know, making sure that you put firm controls and parameters in place to be able to capitalize on the growth, but make sure that actually everything that you do is fully compliant and in line with the policies and governance that you set within the organization as well.
Throughout your career, you've had a few different business cards, right? And I'm always interested in this in terms of, how did you know when it was the right time to leave a role and move on to the next one?
When I stopped learning.
Okay.
I think that was the key part for me. I think, you know, I guess if I look back over the last number of years within sales, long cycle sales, which is pretty much where my career started, you need to build momentum, you need to build relationships, you need to build network. And I think within that environment, you were able to identify quite quickly when you maybe got a little, not bored, I think bored is the wrong phrase, but you become a little stale, right? If you don't get out of the bed in the morning and you feel excited about what the day you have coming ahead of you, then that's perhaps maybe the time that you need to think about what will excite me, what will get me out of the bed in the morning with a bounce in my step. And I think for me, I am incredibly self-aware. I am very focused in terms of the people agenda. I think you highlighted it as part of that introduction. You're deeply passionate about people and payments. And I think if you don't feel that you're adding as much value as you once was, then perhaps maybe you start thinking about what's next for you. So it's from a personal perspective, but also from a professional perspective. I have a huge amount of admiration for folks that stay in the same role for 10, 15, 20 years. And they keep the lights on, they keep the business going, and they're core to business success in every organisation that I've worked within. But for me, I love business change. I love business transformation. I'm a change agent, an orchestrator of change. And I think for me, that element, when you've come in and you've driven those changes that you need to, you've delivered success 2-3 years to be able to really map out and track that success, I'm less excited about BAU, if that makes sense, Aidan. So when it gets to a point where everything's trucking along nicely and we're knocking it out of the park and clients are happy and people are growing and people are learning and the business is thriving, it's at that point I think, okay, what can I add now? What do I need to do differently to be able to keep that spark within me?
Are you a natural disruptor then?
A little bit, yeah. Spirited second child, I think that's what one of my assessments said. I was a spirited second child, and because of that, I love change. Yeah. I love working through change, but incredibly respectful that change is something that people can sometimes struggle with. And in every organisation that I've worked within, I've driven quite a significant amount of change, but I do it with respect, I do it with trust, I do it whilst listening. So within the organisation that I'm in now, in the International Payments Division, rather than coming in and making a whole heap of changes in the very, very early stages, I try to listen and observe. I look in the rearview mirror to learn and to understand rather than to judge. Mm. And I think that's been clear in every role that I've had over the last 15, 20 years. Try and really understand the business, understand the people, understand the customers, understand the business objectives. And once you've got all of those pieces plotted together in terms of that jigsaw, it's at that point you can really understand what you need to do to drive it forward. Creating and crafting business strategies, go to market, whatever it may be, that I really get excited about. And then there's nothing I like more to look back. You know, I see across, you know, other organizations that I've worked within where you can see, you know, a new market has been entered or potentially success has been crafted. And I sit back and I just think that that's quite, you know, quite inspirational for me to think that I've, you know, been part of that or I've had a part to play in that success.
And what personal characteristics do you think are most important as a CEO?
I would say self-awareness.
Okay.
I think self-awareness, right? Knowing where you're strong, knowing where perhaps maybe you need to lean on others, knowing and understanding what you're really strong at. I went through an executive leadership program with Senga Folkman a number of years ago, and I'm still part of the program now. And it's a strengths-based leadership agenda. So whilst highlighting and identifying maybe some of the areas you've got for development, it focuses very much on looking at the areas that you're really strong and finding roles where you can really, really thrive rather than focusing on the negatives of what you don't have and helping to build those. That's still a core part, but actually looking what skills do you have and how best can you apply them to what type of role? So I think for me, going through that leadership and executive program really taught me where I'm strong, what I enjoy, where your passion is. And it's almost like if you can imagine a Venn diagram, right? So you've got the business needs, you've got your passion, right? And then you've got your natural abilities as well. And somewhere in the middle is where the magic really starts to happen.
There's an idea out there, and I would fully agree. I've met loads of CEOs in over my career that, you know, you don't necessarily get better at the job as a CEO, but you do get faster at making the important decisions.
Yes. Yeah.
And that's the key.
Yeah. I have never shied away from making decisions. I'm not suggesting that throughout my career I've always made the right decisions, but I'm never afraid to admit that I'm wrong. And I think that's been fundamental as well. So, you know, whilst if you've got all of the information, you can be quick to make those decisions. I would always do that and still continue to do that now in terms of just validating it, making sure that actually we're doing the right things for the right reasons. And I think that's fundamental, not only just to my success, but in every organisation that I've worked within.
Yeah. What mistake do you think you've learned the most from, and how did you apply those lessons?
Yeah. So personal relationships are key. And a number of years ago, I experienced a challenge, and I misread a relationship. I completely misread it. And perhaps maybe some of the decisions I made around that directed me on a different type of path. And what I mean by that is that when you misread or you don't judge a particular relationship in the right way, what it can do is it can quash your confidence. It perhaps maybe can question the relationships that you have more broadly. And as a result, I would have perhaps maybe put a little bit of a set of boundaries, guards up. So over the years, I've relaxed those a little bit more now than what they were. They're not quite as high as they used to be. But it does teach you to perhaps maybe not take everything at face value.
Yeah. Now, I have been reliably informed that you are a big Jurgen Klopp fan.
Oh,
so what lessons do you think he can bring to being a company CEO?
My goodness,
See, I do my research.
You do. So I'm a huge Liverpool fan. And whether you're a Liverpool fan or not, Jurgen Klopp is up there in terms of leadership. What I love about him and what I try to apply as best as I can is the way that he conducts himself. He took a team a number of years ago that was a good team. It wasn't a great team, but it was a good team. And he completely transformed them. He transformed the way they played. He transformed the way that they worked together. They collaborated. He completely transformed the way that people viewed them, right? So the external perception, the way that the fan base rallied. And he shifted football management in a way that I don't think we had seen over the last number of years. He wasn't given a bucket of cash to do that. So no digs at Man City there. But it did, I suppose, in terms of how I translate that in terms of my CEO role, to be yourself, right? To embrace change, to drive change, but also drive belief. Up until quite recently, my LinkedIn banner behind was a Jurgen Klopp quote, which basically said, all I ask you to do is believe. And I think if you, as a leader, if you can convince your team that there is something genuine to believe in, and they feel that you're a strong leader that they can follow, then I think you can achieve anything. And that, for me, when I look at him, when I look at the impact he's had, not just on the team, but on the game, is pretty, pretty inspirational. He's one of my role models up there, that's for sure.
So he'd be on the list of people you'd have for dinner if I offered you a table of six, you, me,
goodness,
and four others.
Yeah.
Who else would be there?
Well, other than Arna, he's slotted.
You might have a bit of overload on the football if you do.
So I have probably, I have three role models, right? Two of them, one is Jurgen Klopp. Another one are my kids. I have two daughters, and they're role models for me, because when I look at how strong they are, the strong, independent women, and the way that they're kicking ass in their professions now, it makes me incredibly proud. But also, in terms of the way that they hold themselves, they haven't had to go through some of the challenges that I would have gone through as a woman in payments over the last number of years, because of, D&I agendas really make sure that it's a much more level playing field than it ever was. The other person that is a real role model for me that I would love to have had as a dinner date, she sadly passed on, is Grace Hopper. So for those of you that don't know who Grace Hopper is, you should absolutely Google her. She's the reason you've got a laptop. So she was originally the smartest woman in the room back in World War II. She was a Navy admiral. She was a computer scientist. She was one of the original women that coded, right? Which back then in World War II, you would never have, this profession wasn't something that a woman did. And to be able to have had the impact that she's had across the STEM community is really quite inspirational. When you look at the legacy and the impact that she's had, the way that, her foundation continues to drive diversity across the STEM community is pretty inspirational. But when you look at some of the quotes, she was a no-nonsense kick-ass woman. She was incredible. So she would definitely be, I'd have maybe an appetizer with Grace Hopper, but definitely main course and dessert with Jurgen.
Very good. To what extent has fear of failure been a driving force for you in your career?
I don't fear failure. I genuinely don't, right? If you're not failing, you're not learning. And if I think about, you know, some of the failures that would be termed that I've had in the past, they've all been learning exercises for me, right? And I guess that again builds back to that self-awareness element. If you're not failing, if you're always succeeding, what are you teaching yourself? What are you learning? How are you growing? And I think, you know, if you look at perhaps maybe, you know, some of the generations coming through now, sometimes it's everything is great, everything is positive, success, but until you've experienced failure, you can't really be able to grow and learn and develop.
Yeah. So therefore, do you hate losing or love winning?
I love winning. I love winning. I suppose that's a sales girl within me. But winning is an interesting phrase, right? So winning just assumes that there is an outcome, okay? Whereas actually, it's the journey of winning. And if you think about it, a very good friend of mine in the business, he climbs mountains, not just your everyday mountain. I'm talking Everest, Kilimanjaro, all these kinds of mountains. And what he says is when you reach the peak, it feels amazing, but actually you learn more about yourself and others on that journey, on that mountain climb. So I think, you know, I love to win, but I love to learn and grow. And that journey of winning, bringing everybody along, you know, supporting clients or partners, colleagues on that journey as well is really great. But having that, I suppose, the collaborative success of winning, that's what I love.
Yeah, it's the journey more important than the destination.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think, didn't Miley Cyrus sing a song about
that? Yeah, she did indeed. In that regard then, do you obsess about the small things?
I try not to.
Would you probably do a little bit, do you?
A little bit. And I suppose that's the joy, right? As CEO of a regulated legal entity, I do need to sweat the small stuff a little bit. And it's interesting because, you know, in my personal life, I try not to sweat the small things. A little bit of an overthinker, but I think that's inherent in a lot of people. But I try not to get dragged down with those little things, get caught up in the weeds. But sometimes you do. You need to deep down. I'm kind of like the type of individual that likes to know the facts, likes to be able to make decisions based on facts. Data is really important to me. But try not to sweat the small stuff now.
What advice would you give to young people today?
Self-belief, right? Know your value, know your worth. Right. So I know my value and I know my worth, but it took a long time to be able to build the confidence, to be able to really understand what that was. I think for the next generation of payments experts coming through, they need to really understand the value that they bring, not just to the organization and to their team, but to their clients, to their partners, but also to themselves in terms of their own personal growth agenda too. And I think if you know your value and you know your worth, you can be far more confident. But I suppose to know both things, you need to first understand what they are and how to get to that point. And, you know, if you look at the younger generation coming through, whether they're just finishing college, finishing school, going through university or starting on a graduate program, really trying to work out, there's so many different opportunities for them now. And the payments landscape in particular is evolving significantly. Find something that you really enjoy. And if you find that one thing that you really enjoy, like I did with payments, you know, people often said to me, my God, you've been in payments your whole life. Like, have you not got bored? And I can honestly say, no, absolutely not, because the payments landscape has evolved and changed so significantly over the last 30 years that actually it's a different, every year is something completely different. And I think that would be my advice to the younger generation. Find something that you really get excited about, and then keep growing in that space.
Who do you or who have you sought advice from over the years?
So a number of years ago, I was allocated a mentor in Barclays. And my goodness, she was a really tough regional director. And she was the only female in the industry at that point in time. And she scared the bejesus out of me most of the time. But actually, the advice she gave me very early on set me on the right foundation, certainly set up the right foundations to put me on the right path. I would have over the years maintained a really strong mentor network. And I think that's fundamental. I still use and leverage it now, although a lot of people that supported me early in my career are now either retired. But also that mentoring, it reverse mentoring is really important for me as well. So whilst perhaps maybe a lot of people across women in sales, women in payments, women in banking, where I have those mentorship arrangements in place for the last number of years, the challenge that you've got now is how do I stay up to date? So actually, those mentees that I have relationships with for the last number of years, I'm not always sure they really understand the value that they bring back to me, because they allow me to understand what's important to that next generation.
It's the payback and pay forward.
It totally is, right? Yeah. So mentors are a key way, and that's where I would have got a lot of advice, and you know, from colleagues and peers and leadership and all that great stuff. But actually, the mentee relationships that I have, the sponsor relationships that I have, those that I'm coaching, those that I'm supporting, those that I'm working with within my own organization and more broadly across the group and the industry, the perspectives that you get by linking in, the advice that you get there is worth an absolute fortune. It's worth its weight in gold.
How do you deal with setbacks?
Just get on with it, right? I never take anything personally, although that's hard, right? I say that and then I reflect. No, it's really hard not to take things personally. But actually, you know,
achieve nothing by doing it.
No, it's not directed at me. It's directed at a scenario or a topic or, you know, particular scenario that someone's unhappy with. But the reality is, as long as you can separate yourself from that, you know, put everything into perspective, remain impartial. You just get on with it. Yeah. Setbacks, they're a fundamental part. But again, it comes back to mistakes and failures, right? It's a learning opportunity.
And then, you know, what percentage of your success do you think is down to luck and what do you think is hard work?
Say 50-50.
Would you? You're the most honest person so far. Most people will go 80% hard work and 50% and 20% luck.
Oh, really? Yeah. No, I'd say it's 50-50. You've got to be in the right place at the right time. Yeah. Take advantage of the right opportunities as they come along. You know, and I think I'm not suggesting for 1 minute that it hasn't been hard work. And, you know, it's been hard work in some areas where it shouldn't have been so hard. And I, you know, refer back just to, you know, being a woman in sales and a woman in payments. It was really tough back, you know, a number of years because, you know, the industry wasn't blessed to have as many females within the industry as what we have now. So, you know, it has been tough. But actually, there is a huge element of luck, and luck can come across and manifest itself as timing, as network, as connections. But yeah, I'd say 50-50.
Right, we've reached the final question.
The
big black book is coming out. The black book is coming out, right? Right.
Come on.
This is an interesting one.
Oh, God.
This is an interesting one.
Right.
What has made you the most uncomfortable in your career?
The most uncomfortable. So I think going back to when I misread a particular relationship, because it made me reevaluate all the relationships that I had, both on a personal and a professional level. It made me, you know, reevaluate the way that I dress, the way that I look, the way that I articulate myself. It made me think about myself completely differently. Great question. Does that answer it for you?
It does. It does, absolutely. And I'm going to break with tradition here because something else has just come to my mind.
Okay.
Because you've had such a long career in payments. Have you ever thought about going into a completely different direction?
No.
No.
Well, so when I first left school, I wanted to be a veterinary nurse.
Right.
So if by any chance my numbers came up tonight and I won the lottery, I would volunteer for perhaps maybe the ISPCA or something like that. I'm a crazy dog lady. So the opportunity to work in that space, but I'm guessing it probably isn't going to pay. So until those numbers come up, it's payments for me.
Very good. Well, that's it for this episode of Everyday Business with Aidan Donnelly. I'd just like to thank my guest, Sarah Savage. Don't forget to like, share, subscribe or comment if you enjoyed what you heard. Many thanks and we will see you the next time.
The participants in this podcast have done so for the purpose of sharing their own individual business experiences. Some are clients of Davy and some are not. They have not received a gratuity or other payment for their time in making the podcast. The views expressed throughout are their own. Warning: the information in this podcast is not a recommendation or investment research. It does not purport to be financial advice. You should speak to your advisor in the context of your own personal circumstances prior to making any financial or investment decision. In the Republic of Ireland, J&E Davy Unlimited Company, trading as Davy and Davy Private Clients, is regulated by the Central Bank of Ireland. Davy is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group. In the United Kingdom, Davy Private Clients UK, Davy UK and Davy Capital Markets UK are the trading names of J&E Davy UK Limited. J&E Davy UK Limited is authorised and regulated by the Financial Conduct Authority. J&E Davy UK Limited is a Davy Group company and also a member of the Bank of Ireland Group.